From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Television has had a dramatic and continual effect on the lives of Americans. No other medium has been so powerful. Parker Page is president of the Children's Television Resource and Education Center. We'll discuss the effect of television on our children today, as well as a newer source of family entertainment, the video game. Later, I'll talk with Andy and Tina Rathbone, both authors of popular computer books. They'll discuss new trends in computers for the home, as well as the new ways in which these home computers are being used. Many of us today can remember the first television which our families owned, and of course we all remember our favorite programs. As president of the Children's Television Resource and Education Center, Parker Page has kept on watching children's shows and all the shows on television. I asked him how television has changed from the 50s and 60s to the television of today.
Oh my goodness, it's really the difference between night and day. I also was from that generation. For instance, one thing that's different, when I was growing up in my hometown, there were three channels. Two of them were constantly fuzzy on a rotating basis. I never knew what I was going to get to watch. But today, the average American household has 30.5 channels to choose from, soon to go to 500. So the amount of television that people have watched back when you and I started watching was about 3 hours a day the TV was on in the average home. It's now up to 7 hours. It's been that way for 6 or 7 years now. Kids watch 3.5, 4 hours of television a day, every day. So millions of kids watch less, but there have been studies that show possibly upwards of 1 million kids watch over 6 hours of television every single day between the ages of 2 and 11. That's a 40-hour work week. Only the work those kids are doing is watching TV. So on the one hand, we're watching a lot more. Everybody's got one. 98% of the nation's families own a TV. Two-thirds of us own two or more TV sets. I recently read there's a television being manufactured now for every child being born in the world. So the good news is we don't have to argue about what to watch or not watch. What's also changed is the content. You and I used to watch every now and then slapstick cartoons and a few other shows with Howdy Doody and Captain Kangaroo. And the content of television has changed for both children and adults. So the slapstick is still there, but that's a minor part of what's available to kids. Kids now watch much more, in terms of violence, for instance, much more reality-based violence, much less pro-social behavior going on between characters like Gunsmoke and Bonanza. It's much more vigilante violence. As you know, the violence has increased tremendously. So both in content as well as how much kids are watching, it's a whole different world than the 50s and 60s and even 70s.
You know, it is funny. I remember it was such a big thing when television came to our home. First of all, it was a huge mahogany set. I mean, it probably weighed a ton. The set weighed a ton. The cabinet weighed a ton. And it was off to one side in the living room. The living room was all organized so people could talk to each other. And this thing was off to the side. And one wouldn't design a room that way today. And you had to sit in this one chair kind of side saddle to watch the television because it was kind of over there. And I tried to think of the programs, like the Children's Hour, and we had the Merry Milkman. I was even on it once and sat on his lap. It's, you know, but there was no videotaping, so it's like my family has to recount this. It's not like we can go and watch it.
That's right.
And there were these very primitive cartoons, and the Mickey Mouse Club was major. And you had to be there if you. And so there was an excitement and an arrival time, and you really did organize your life. But there wasn't that much to organize. There weren't 15,000 programs a day. There was, you know, one or two that you were allowed to watch, and you got there. So things were different, and I knew that when I took my sons and my nephews on vacation recently, and they were watching a channel where old black and white cartoons came on. And we thought, isn't this great? And we watched it for a couple of minutes. We went out in the kitchen, and they were watching it, and then they came out and said, is it okay if we turn off that gray program? So, this is different. This is different. So if we get to the reality today and what's going on. 2 years ago, everyone was upset with The Simpsons. Another program we hear about again and again is Beavis and Butthead. Are these two very different programs, or are they the same? Or you know, is there, what are we looking at here?
Well, I don't think they're the same either in terms of the animation or the writing. I like to think that Beavis and Butthead is probably the only program that can make the folks in Wayne's World look like they graduated from Harvard. I mean, it is, as an adult, it's very especially an adult with children, it's very tough to watch the show. I know that for some teenagers, it's absolutely wonderful, but it's one of those things where you think you've reached your limit at 1978 or 1988, and one show after another comes along that pushes that envelope of mindlessness, and for me, Beavis and Butthead does that, and that's my personal opinion of it. I don't have a problem with it for older kids, which supposedly it's targeted for, 13, 14, 15, 16-year-olds, because supposedly by that age, those kids supposedly know something about the real world. They know that you don't blow up cats, that you don't burn down houses, that no matter what the cartoons say, that's a fantasy. My difficulty is more for the kids who are 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, and evidently the show's real popular with that group too. I think that's a difficult issue, and I think it's one that, as you may have read, Nickelodeon, who owns MTV, addressed very quickly after the five-year-old burned the house down in terms of changing some of the content of that program. I think they need to take a look at other content also.
Well, Terry Ricolta, who is founder and director of the Detroit-based Americans for Responsible Television, she's called Beavis and Butthead a parent's worst nightmare. Now, what may appear from a distance to be an innocent cartoon actually is showing an M80 being used to shoot a cat at close quarters and showing characters inhaling paint thinner, and it goes on from there. Where does the freedom of speech run up against the protection of children?
I think it's real difficult. Again, I go back to the issue of who is the primary audience, and I think the primary audience for this supposedly is 13, 14 year olds and up, and at some point you have to say those kids are responsible for taking the perceptions that they get off of any program or any movie or any video game and having enough sense and taking enough responsibility not to act on that. What I'd really like to see, because I also think kids are a great human resource and should be protected, I'd really like to see more detailed information for parents about the particular shows that are available for kids. I don't think this one excessive violence rule, which is the labeling that's come about from this summer's hearings and a number of other discussions and conferences, is enough. I think there needs to be a standardized rating system. The other thing I'd like to see, especially in terms of Beavis and Butthead, I would really move that program farther back into the evening. I would move that program into a 9, 10 o'clock time slot, because I don't think it should be available when most 4 and 5-year-old kids are going to be watching it. But it's a very difficult issue, and I really am not for censoring the media. It goes against my grain, but I also think that they need to provide us, parents and others, with more detailed information and with a standardized rating system for all their programs.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Parker Page. Dr. Page is the president of the Children's Television Resource and Education Center. One difference between television and movies is that on television, everything is accessible to anyone who turns it on at any time. In a movie, you can look at the rating. You can choose, do we go there or not? You can move in the door. You can walk out. That's not true of television. So how are ratings or even information going to stop a kid from turning on a particular program?
May not. I think the time schedule is also important in terms of moving programs that are more violent or that are more sexually explicit into time periods that are later in the evening, that are not seen as, quote, the family hour or the beginning of prime time. I think that's one way to do it. I think the other is that given the accessibility of television, we have to expect that that's going to be an issue. And I think it's going to be a bigger issue. The more and more channels that are available, my understanding is that 500 channels will be available within the next year or so. And with the sort of superhighway concept in which video games will also be available on channels, I think it puts a greater burden on parents, and I hope that it also puts a greater social responsibility burden on the video game makers as well as the networks and other video producers to, again, to handle as well as possible by moving time slots and also providing a rating system. And some kids and some programs will fall through the cracks and kids will watch them, and that's part of growing up in the 90s.
I remember my parents refused to let us watch the Untouchables, the old Untouchables, because it was too violent. And now it just seems so tame.
It really does, doesn't it?
Yes, it's almost laughable, but there you have it.
And that's really a difference. At least the TV research on TV violence. There used to be a lot, you know, there used to be violence in the Untouchables. You mentioned that. There was also Bonanza, lots of shootouts. There was Gunsmoke. But there was a way as a child, a young child especially, you could separate that. I mean, the violence happened with white hats and black hats on dusty streets, on horseback, or in the case of the Untouchables, they were in wide lapel suits with huge hats and on running boards of very old-looking cars. There was a way to separate you as the viewer from the violence that was going on, and that's changed. That's probably one of the largest changes in the violence. Is the violence now looks like it takes place in shopping centers, very similar to where you go with your mom, or it looks like it takes place on highways that you go down every day to school, or it takes place in neighborhoods that are very similar to yours. And so that sets up quite a confusion for younger children. And for older children, what it says is that the children are probably more likely to internalize that violence and to imitate it.
I am struck by what you said, and that the children are able to differentiate between it's sort of pretend on TV versus it's real. And I remember that very distinctly. My oldest son was maybe only 3 1/2, couldn't even have been 4. And I looked over, and it was rather late at night, but has always liked to stay up late. And I went, oh, my goodness, you know, just the opening shots of this television program. I rushed over, you know, and I hit the off button, and he came rushing over with me and was calming me down, thinking I was upset by what I saw. And he goes, Mom, it's only pretend, only television, only make-believe. And he clearly understood that at 3 1/2 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pretty impressed. But as you say, when it's very close to their own environment, how do they decide? How do they know that?
They're very bad at it. Another point on that, and what the research shows is even though you can distinguish between reality and fantasy, that doesn't necessarily mean that you won't internalize that behavior. The clearest, and I think a more dramatic example than you'll usually find in the population, is the Beavis and Butthead one, in which Beavis and Butthead blew up cats and a few kids across the United States decided to imitate that. Clearly, Beavis and Butthead is a cartoon, and we're talking about kids who are 13 and 14 years old. So even though you know it's fantasy, sometimes that doesn't affect your behavior attitudes.
One part of television, as you're saying, is that it's brought us video games. In your view, how are video games affecting our kids?
We don't have a lot of research in that area. I wish we had more. At this point, I think everybody's opinion is equally valid. We've got about, for instance, the issue of video game violence, which is the one that seems most important to adults as well as to policymakers now. There have been less than a dozen published reports, experimental reports, on the effects of video game violence on kids. And you compare that with the television violence research. We've got 30 years of research, 2 Surgeon General reports, over 1,000 studies and reports and experiments. So there's not a lot to go on. But having said that, the few studies that I've seen look very closely like the results that have come from the great bulk of the TV violence research, and that is for some kids it looks like they may be more likely, those who play violent video games, to be aggressive towards other kids and more tolerant of aggression in the real world. So that's what we know so far, but we don't know a lot. I hope that what comes out of this brouhaha, which has gone on over the last couple of months around Mortal Kombat, will really set up some new research, some good independent short and long term research. But the Mortal Kombat is interesting in that what it really brings us to is a whole new level of video game technology. For the first time, we've got realistic human digitalized images which are being able to be implanted into those video games, so that no longer is it Super Mario Brothers bonking or being bonked over the head or
eating pizzas or the hedgehog
or whatever. We now have lifelike figures who are involved in very high levels of violence. And what the TV research would say about that is, and we talked about it a little bit before, the more realistic the violence is, the more likely the kids are to imitate it. So that's sort of where we stand with it. I think, you know, actually, I think we'll look back in 12, 18 months tops and say that Mortal Kombat was this sort of quaint and archaic little game, a lot like The Untouchables was a quaint and archaic TV program. I think that that players will be able to torture, maim, and kill characters in ways that are unimaginable to us at this point within a very short period of time.
I knew you were coming on, and of course I have two boys who love video games, and so I wasn't about to buy Mortal Kombat.
I did.
But you did.
For my 13-year-old girl.
For your 13-year-old girl, yeah. And so we went to the pizza parlor. Now, I was pretty amazed at how this thing worked, and it was pretty realistic. And I know as a computer person that it's only going to get more realistic. How far do we want to go? Where do we want to draw the line?
Right. Well, I have to have this qualifying statement. I didn't buy Mortal Kombat for my 13-year-old daughter. I bought it so that she could help me play it. I couldn't get past, you know, the first attack, counterattack. And I don't know whether you did in the arcade or not, but I've had the opportunity to see the final fatal moves, which, of course, for me, you have to play. You know, I would be on Social Security by the time I got through to that level. But for the regular arcade game players, there are the final moves in which you pull out your opponent's beating heart and pull the spine and the skull out and the various other wonderful ways of disemboweling your opponent when you want to do the final death kill. The question about where do we stop, I really think, is a question that the video game industry has got to address. As you know, Sega came out with the Mortal Kombat at its most goriest. Nintendo cut out, so to speak, the death moves. I appreciate the fact that Sega came out with a rating system, and I now understand that it is an independent rating system. That is, there's a nonprofit that rates these games for Sega. I think that the entire industry has got to come out with a rating system and a detailed rating system that says more than MA-13 or PG-15 or something. It's got to say what the content of these games are that make them such that they need to be within a certain category. And I think that the industry has got to voluntarily come together and say, look, we agree to put a cap on brutality, a cap on mayhem, that whether it's entertainment or not and whether it gets us another extra X number of bucks, it simply is not good for kids in the short term. Common sense and the research we do have says that, and it's certainly not good for society in the long term.
My guest today is Parker Page. He is the creator of Getting Along, a collection of stories, songs, and activities aimed at encouraging children to work and play together, and he is the president of the Children's Television Resource and Education Center. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. One private school in San Francisco requires parents to agree that while their children are attending the school, they will not permit them to watch television or play video games. Is this going too far?
I don't know whether I would couch it as going too far. We often meet in the national presentations and regional presentations that we do of helping children survive television. We often meet parents who simply have deleted television from their lifestyle and from their homes and who are doing quite well without it, thank you very much, and would like to see the rest of the world follow suit. I don't believe that's practical. I don't believe with 98% of the homes having television sets and the TV being on an average of 7 hours a day, that for most people, I don't think giving up television is a practical alternative. That's why we choose to try and give information that can help parents help their kids become more selective viewers and, in terms of the video games, more selective players. I can't say whether it's going too far or not. I think if it's possible to do it, and that seems like the family values that you want to present to your children, I think that's fine. I think that television and video games both have things going for them, have benefits. Both television and video games are relaxing. Television can be a window to the world. They can be a form of entertainment. They can give children insights that they wouldn't have without television and its images. In terms of video games can be another form of electronic board games that we used to play years ago, you know, back in 1985 and 1986. They can provide children with a way to learn new game strategies, to increase their concentration skills. They can be a great form of socialization for kids when they play with other kids or when they play with family members. So it's the old saw, I think, of it's not the technology that's at fault. You have to take a look at the content of what's available for anybody who's playing or watching. And the fact is, with 500 channels, there is enough content out there that both children and adults can benefit from television and video games.
Television and video games, to me, speak isolation. The center developed Getting Along, cassette tape, activity book, all this type of thing to help social skills. Tell us about that, and tell us if you weren't tempted to also make a videotape.
We were tempted to make a videotape, and that may happen at some other point. And in fact, Getting Along may turn into software very quickly.
Ooh.
And well, one of the interesting aspects of that will be to make it as social as we possibly can, in which teamwork and collaboration will be an aspect of that. Getting Along really came out of my interest in problem solving and conflict resolution, which I've been involved in developing models for young kids all the way through to adults. Over the years, and Getting Along really helps kids deal with the growing up issues, the usual at your house and at mine, fighting, selfishness, bullying, teasing, disrespect for property, intolerance for individual differences, you know, the biggies. And we wanted to develop both the curriculum, which is sold in schools, as well as Getting Along Stories and Songs, which is a less sophisticated version, which is sold in bookstores and toy stores for families and for kids. We wanted to develop a way that kids could deal with those universal issues that would be fun and exciting. The animals have a very sort of hip, sort of Gary Larson-esque twist to them. So we try not to do anything saccharine. We try and play it as realistically as we can, and we try to make it sort of a group of fun adventure stories and songs for kids. And so we try and do the best of both worlds, which is to reach kids where they are and also take them a little farther down the road towards pro-social development.
How much television is too much television for what age? And what kind of television, other than violence, is the wrong kind of television for what age?
That's a tough one. I think that the way the American Pediatric Association, as well as the PTA and a number of other groups, have sort of come to a consensus, and I'm not sure where it came from, but I tend to agree with it, which is 1 to 2 hours of television per day, not just night, but 1 to 2 hours of TV a day seems to be a fairly good limit for kids on weekdays. I would say the same thing for video game playing, only less. I would say probably if your combined entertainment is over 2 hours, then you ought to take a look at what else your kids are missing in their lives. Because remember, the average child in the United States watches 3.5 to 4 hours a day, every day. So to move it down to that 1 hour or so limit, I think, is a good approach. And in terms of what kids watch or don't watch, the easiest way for me to figure out what my children shouldn't watch is to sit down and watch a program with them, one that I think that would be fine to watch. And then if after 6 minutes I'm not sweating bullets and wishing that the commercial would come so I can get her out of the room, then I know that I've gotten a good program.
Probably okay.
Probably okay.
we rented a PG-13 movie the other day. You were talking about rating systems. And this was for my 10-year-old. And while there was no sex and no, you know, shady language, there was plenty of violence. And there was plenty of massively dysfunctional behavior that I don't want to send the message that this is okay to act this way. What are the rating systems telling us, and how might they change to help us?
I don't know that they will change. I think the rating systems for movies have been set and standardized over a long period of time. I think what's going to have to happen is that parents are going to have to take on the responsibility of deciding whether those programs, no matter what the ratings are, work for their 10 or 11-year-old if it's a PG-13 film. One of the interesting aspects to me, for instance, was Jurassic Park. As you remember, that movie was PG-13. Steven Spielberg said, I wouldn't let a child go to that who's younger than 13. And yet, as you probably know, there were lines and lines, millions of parents bringing their 5- and 6- and 7-year-old kids to a movie that was clearly not appropriate for them. And I understand the reason for it. I understand Spielberg's reputation. I understand the marketing that had toys that were geared for kids 5 and 6 years old that were Jurassic Park toys and the fast food tie-ins. And so there's a way in which the marketing, regardless of what the overall rating system is, sort of undercuts that, and I'd really like to see the industry stop that. But I think closer to home, what needs to happen is parents need to make comments, talk back to those movies, talk back to those TV programs, especially in your own home, and let kids know that you don't approve of the violent behavior that those characters are engaged in. On the other hand, you can also talk about the behavior you do approve of characters in programming. That's been shown to be very effective with kids when parents will make comments about characters' behavior that they like or don't like. The unfortunate part is most of the time, parents tend to believe that children understand everything they're seeing on television and can make that judgment when, in fact, they can't.
Now, you are the president of the Children's Television Resource and Education Center. What programs are you making a point of seeing right now?
Well, you understand, I have to. We're still not large enough that I can send somebody else out.
I know, you
to
have
watch,
to see it.
To watch.
You got to
so
see
I've
it.
So I've got to see almost everything. And so I've spent, especially in the fall, I spend the first few weeks watching on Saturday morning and weekday afternoons and in the evenings. And what I really think is important is that parents decide what programs have the values that are important to them and the interests that are important to them and the themes that they want their kids to be involved in and to understand and interact with. Because especially for young children, what the research shows is seeing a video or seeing a program, especially if you see it over and over again, which kids love to do, that it's like being read a very large picture book to. They tend to internalize that just like they would you're reading a story to them over and over again. So I think parents really need to choose their own particular programs that they like or think that their kids will benefit from. I really think it's a family decision.
So you personally, as a parent, have to invest your time, sit down, watch the television, and make that decision.
You have to do that, and it seems difficult, and it seems like a burden. And, in fact, you can do it fairly quickly vis-a-vis the first of the fall season, as well as reading write-ups in the papers and reading the TV guides or the local TV guides about what the programs are about. And whether it's a burden or not a burden, the issue is so large about the effects of television on kids' lives that it's one parent responsibility that has to be undertaken. If present trends continue, by the time the average American child reaches 65 years old, he or she will have spent 7 full years of their lives in front of the television set. It's just too much time to spend without being guided by adults around you.
Parker, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
My guest today has been Parker Page. He's the president of the Children's Television Resource and Education Center, a nonprofit organization helping children to survive television. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Andy and Tina Rathbone could certainly be called a computer couple. Andy is author of the popular PCs for Dummies, while Robin's latest book is Hundreds of Fascinating and Unique Ways to Use Your Computer. While there are new developments in the area of home computers every day, I wondered if a lot of personal computers in homes were not being used at all.
I'd say so. I'd say that up until now, the consumer has been faced with a lot of productivity software, whatever that is, word processing, databases. You know, it's great for the office and all, but how can you really turn that to productive use at home? I think now the software publishers are seeing that, and they're starting to plan software that where you can plan a wedding or plan your budget or take a vacation or lay out a garden or even a quilt. You can do a lot of fun things now.
Well, I always say it's not a home computer until it can julienne my potatoes. And I use computers all the time in my work, but I haven't really come up with a lot of home uses. You know, let's just go into detail on some of them.
Sure. For example, imagine being a gardener. That's America's number one hobby, I think. You can actually lay out a garden plan based on your measurements of your backyard or even a deck if you don't have a real garden. And then pick plant varieties. The programs come with a list, also called a database, of plants that will do well in your particular zone. I don't think San Francisco is a zone 9. I know San Diego is, where I'm from. Plants that will thrive in a particular lighting location or under certain soil conditions. I know in Southern California we have terribly alkaline, dry, salty soil, and we can't grow everything down there. So for me to be able to plan a garden this way, and then it even pops up a list of, say, certain distributors who sell maybe the more rare breeds that I come up with. That's just one start for gardening software.
So instead of having to read a lot of books, you can specifically ask questions about where you are and get specific answers.
You can do the layout of the graphical look and all and plan. There's one program that's wonderful. It's for the Macintosh platform. It actually grows in the different varieties so that you can see what your garden will look like a year later and make sure that, the big shrub won't shade those sunny annuals and all.
How do you find out where to get this kind of stuff? I mean, that's like a garden software. I mean, you know how to find word processing software.
That's right. One place to find this type of software is in my book. Other ways, the software stores are increasingly realizing that the home user has a voice out there, too, and they're voting with their dollars. But you see home decorating software where your computer can move the furniture and you don't have to. Also, a lot of trip planning software now with maps, even type in your coordinates. You've got to get across town during rush hour, say, in San Francisco, and the computer will show you on the screen the quickest way from here to there.
First of all, my garden is a mess, and it's going to stay that way. It's hard enough to get around with my computer. Writing checks has never appealed to me on a home computer basis. I mean, do you use the home computer to write your checks?
We keep our checkbook on the home computer, although there is a step further where you can actually write electronic checks, and the bank will process that. Of course, you've got to arrange things beforehand with your bank and all, but more and more banks are even offering their own versions of this, and I think it's a definite trend. Again, computers making the lifestyle easier for people. And in fact, we're seeing some actual computer types now. The hardware manufacturers, for example, Compaq, come out with a Presario computer, which actually has a welcoming center, all the software installed for normal uses like word processing and all, and even a fax modem and telephone answering machine included. So we see the software changing, and happily now, finally, the computer industry is changing a little bit too toward the home user, the consumer.
I can see your point about the check writing, how it can be a hassle, and I thought that it would be a hassle having to do the check and then do it on the computer as well. But just 2 months ago, I was doing our checks, and I was going through and itemizing our MasterCard bill, which can take a long time, and normally I thought that it was a pain. But I looked, and I checked, and there was a contact lens place that had overcharged us. We'd returned some lenses and gotten some cheaper ones, but they'd kept the expense for the higher ones. So I called them up, and the guy agreed and sent us a check for $120. But if I hadn't have had the computer that was prodding me to go over the expenses and itemize them out, I never would have known.
Another good benefit, too, is that those checkbook trackers will categorize different expenses. For example, plants for your garden, or tax deductibles, medical expenses, school expenses, any category that you choose can come up there. And even if you write a check, say, to San Francisco or Pacific Gas and Electric, or isn't that the local?
Mm-hmm.
Then you start typing in Pacific, and it's going to give you that. It's going to fill out the rest of that field because it's seen that.
It doesn't take as long as you might think.
Yeah.
And then once you've got it all done at tax time, you push a button and get the printout to give to your tax guy. And so you don't have to give him all the receipts. You've got everything, you know, added up and ready to go.
And that'll save you money if he or she is charging you by the hour.
Now, Tim, you write a check. You're out at the shopping mall. You live in San Diego. That's why I can say that. You're at the shopping mall. San Francisco, you would be at the neighborhood store. But how do you get that into your computer?
Well, I sit down once a month when I'm paying all my bills, and then I look at the checks I've written that month, and then just plug in.
So you enter them all then sort of at one time?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Just sit down.
So you don't need the computer to do it?
No.
Okay.
It just comes in handy when I pay the bills on the first of the month.
Uh-huh.
That's the time I sit down and do the legwork.
But so, programs like that are actually included in some of the lifestyle computers that I was mentioning, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not only good for just your checkbook, but imagine being able to plan toward a goal, a financial goal, maybe a really great vacation or a college diploma for your children. You can actually set up financial goals, and the program will help organize you. Again, computers are just great at keeping you organized in all types of ways.
Now, what other ways do you use your computers at home?
Well, I'm a writer by trade, so I always log on to some of the online services like CompuServe or Prodigy and go to the new users area where people are confused about their computers and they call up and they say, my printer's going double space, you know, what's going wrong? And they'll find answers that way. But I also see, double space, that's something I got to cover in the next book.
Well, I was going to ask you about your book, you know, I have to say something about the name of your book, you know, PC for Dummies. I mean, do you have to have low self-esteem to identify with your book?
I don't think so. I think that a lot of people are just so confused about computers that they just say, you know, hey, I'm a computer dummy, you know, just start me off. Where's the on switch? I mean, I'd feel like a dummy if I was sitting back there at your recording console with how many buttons you got in front of you there?
It's okay. I don't use any of them.
Smart people just feel like a dummy. Like, I feel like a dummy when I'm in a new rental car. How's that one? And I'm trying to find the fuel release cap at the gas station. I turn on the windshield wipers, and I mean, that's a visible evidence of a dummy sitting inside
that
vehicle.
I'm a dork.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guests today are Andy and Tina Rathbone. Andy is the author of the popular PCs for Dummies, while Tina is the author of hundreds of fascinating and unique ways to use your computer. We're talking about how people actually use computers in their home, because so many people have gotten them, and it's sort of like they've stopped. Almost like their kids have started to use them more than the adults.
Yeah, a lot of kids are helping their parents buy computers because they know more about them than the parents do. In the schools these days, the kids don't take typing classes as much as they take computer keyboarding classes. So a lot of them can be a valuable asset to their parents.
You guys are the classic computing couple. You know, I can imagine you're both writing and you're both sitting at your respective computers, you know, playing
even
footsie,
our cat,
I guess.
Our cat's name is Laptop, okay? Pretty bad.
That is bad. There you have it. That's what you got to do. How many computers do you have at home?
Oh, boy.
Depends on the month or something. We must have six or seven right now.
Uh-huh. Six or seven. How do you decide on what computers to buy? Do you argue about that?
No. Just Andy, for example, got a 486 50 megahertz, real fast one.
A book on OS 2, I wanted a book that, or a computer that could make that software really move. So that's what I got. But we're in the industry, so, you know, we can go out there and get a computer for this and a computer for that for all these specialized needs. But it's only now that the consumer is finally having PCs packaged as an appliance. I mean, they can go to their consumer electronics store and say, I want a home PC, you know, take it home and plug it in like it was a microwave oven. There are a lot of those choices that they just don't have to make anymore.
I think that's something that has come along. I mean, initially there was a big advertising campaign, perhaps, I'm going to say 7-8 years ago. It's like, how many manuals, you know who you are, how many manuals do you need to get this computer started? And now with this sort of packaging of many different things in together, I think some people, maybe time to step up. to it.
Well, yeah, it's about time the computer manufacturers wised up and realized that people don't want to learn how to build a computer. I mean, it's like when you buy a car, you don't want to put the car together in your garage and put the air conditioner in there.
Mm-hmm.
You just want to get the car and you want to drive it. You know, so finally the computers are being packaged the same way.
When you write a book like PCs for Dummies or Modems for Dummies or Windows for Dummies or any of these books, what's your orientation? What do you, you know, what do you, when you say the person's going to read this, what do I got to tell that person?
Well, I think about my mom. I mean, she works at the medical examiner's office, but she doesn't know that much about computers, and so I got to try and teach her in a way that she'll know what buttons she has to push at the right time, but she won't just fall asleep trying to find the information. So I guess she's an inspiration.
In trying to figure out how we really use the computer, one way that I use it a lot, and a lot of people use it, is in getting involved with our kids' schools, because we're constantly, you have a flyer for this and an announcement for that, and you actually, you know all the homes that have the computers in them, because then you call them up and say, will you write me a flyer for this? And there's a lot of graphics and word processing and that type of thing, so that it's really unusual. In the old days, you'd get a lot of handwritten or manual type notices home. You don't see that anymore. Everything that comes home looks real slick now, and independent of who makes it. So there's been a real change.
Yeah. Well, that's why I got a computer when I was in college, and I had to do so many term papers. And then one day I had to have a 10-page paper due the next day, and I just cranked, and all I could come up with 8 pages. And so I went into the margins, and I squeezed the margins in just by a quarter inch a little bit, and then changed the spacing just a little bit, and, you know, blam, there's my 10-page report. And so I was sold on computers right then. That was it.
There's some corollary to Cliff's notes in here. I don't know.
Do not try this at home.
Yeah, any students listening, don't. Nah, this can't be the case. Of course, another thing is that last night I was sitting there happily helping my son do his homework, and by golly, I wasn't the only one. I got a call from another mother who said, do you have the homework? And I said, well, yes. And we're talking a third grader. She says, has he filled it in yet? So it was on one sheet, and he had to write all these things. And I said, no. And she goes, good. That means you can fax it to me.
Ah.
So if he had already filled in the answers, it wouldn't have done it. She would have had to call somebody else with another fax. So things are going around a lot differently. Let's talk a little about some of the software I know I was unfamiliar with, such as sewing software.
Oh, yeah, there are pattern design programs which are wonderful. Sometimes we just don't want to go out and buy another pattern for $16.50 now or whatever.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, I'm an avid sewer. Actually,
the last time I sewed anything, it was $3 for a really big dress.
Yeah. No, they're a little more now. And you don't need that because patterns are basically just a few central shapes. You've got a top and you've got a bottom and maybe some pants and you can play with that. Anyway, you just plug in your information, in this case your measurements, and choose what you want, a tunic or a top or a dress, and then out comes a pattern. You print it out on your dot matrix printer or laser
How
printer.
Is it wide enough then?
You put a couple pieces together. Sometimes you do that with a normal pattern too, so.
As I recall, then you have little dots that say, hey, put this on a fold, like that, so that even though your paper may be narrower, you can put several together and cut it out. Now, if you were a sewer, now you're really talking to me, Tina. This is, if I ever go back to sewing, definitely a sewing packet.
Yeah, it's handier than you'd think. Of course, there are basic directions, too, so I think the person's learning a little more about their hobby rather than just kind of blindly following maybe a purchase pattern. You're learning kind of the concept behind patterns and
you're getting some additional assistance because you don't always want it. You may want a little pleated front or you may want something like that, and I'm sure a computer could help you make adjustments, whereas you're just kind of flying blind. I had a lot of flying blind sewing.
Well, one thing that really, really caught my eye was Tina was showing me some quilting software where it would rearrange the patterns on the screen so you could see what your finished quilt would look like depending on how you organized the squares when you were sewing them.
They're pretty sophisticated now, so you could choose actual, calico patterns or something to resemble the fabric that you've lined up and then play with color and shading. I know one of the important things to quilters isn't not so much the colors they're using, but the light and dark values, and if that's going to be a striking, if things contrast well enough or don't contrast, whatever look they want, you can really get it with the programs, though. Anyway, there's the electronic quilt and a couple of others. They're really fun to play with, especially with your color color screen and
kept me amused for hours.
He did, but he likes Jack's better. That's his favorite.
I like that. Actually, that's one of the first uses, home uses, I've really thought of for, that has come to my attention for a color monitor, because sometimes they, oh, that's nice, it's color, but it doesn't really make any difference that it's, you know, blue and white.
Well, it does now. I mean, for a while you could get away with the black and white monitor, but now the programmers think that everybody has color, so they're putting all the shadings of their words and their
menus.
Backgrounds. So if you don't have a color monitor, it's just really hard to see what is highlighted on the screen so you know what button to push.
My guests today are Andy and Tina Rathbone, both authors of popular computer books. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. One thing that seems to be coming up is home inventories, in terms of insurance and that type of thing. It seems to me this is a natural for the computer. Are there whole programs like that, or you just use your word processor?
No, there are programs that are more suited toward home inventory because they're database programs, which lets you search on value. So you could say line up all your possessions in order of value to say maybe videotape the 10 most important ones to you, or sort them by date of purchase or something. They're a great way of keeping track of things, and something a lot of people don't think of. You know, when there's a fire, unfortunately, or a loss, it's nice to have records.
And if you did it with a word processor, you'd have to type in, you know, VCR, and then, you know, $150, and so. But this one already has the stuff in there, so you just scroll down the list to, you know, hit VCR and scroll down a little further or up a little and get TV, and you don't have to type that stuff in.
I see your options already. Because most people have TVs and refrigerators and stuff, and you're right.
It saves a lot of extra work. People think of computers, they think of making more work, you know, typing all that stuff in. But if you get the right program, it makes it simpler.
Anybody who's ever lost a job, thought about changing a job, thought about changing careers, has read What Color Is Your Parachute? Mm-hmm. And I have to say, most people have bought more than one copy. And one of the things that struck me about that book is that you got to write all these things down, and it's really great, and it's one of the most popular books of all times, and just continues to this day. I understand now that there's now a computerized version of What Color Is Your Parachute?
Books like What Color Are Your Parachute help you to develop awareness of your own strengths or weaknesses, a new career path, or brushing up on the older one. And the software merely helps put those exercises in a more organized fashion, helping you get through the different modules and all in a pleasant environment, and maybe kind of spurs you onward where you might have given up if it were a normal print book.
And you test computer games. What do you do when you test a computer game?
Oh, boy, invite the friends over and fight over the good joystick. It's a problem. There's so much of a variety out there in games. Some of them go really elaborate into the sound systems, and some of them you just hear the beep out of the computer's speaker. And just by getting in there and playing them is the only way to see how much detail they have and how long you can play them before you get bored. Some of them I haven't got bored yet, and others you get bored after 15 minutes of the same thing.
Well, when you say you test them, I mean, are you looking for errors? Or are you trying to make them break, or what?
No, just seeing how they'll hold up. Just, playing them. It's my job to play games so the consumer will know what they're getting into when they buy the computer.
Poor guy.
Yeah, that's a job. just sort of turning back again to some of these applications that I was amazed about. There are some that help you with love and relationship skills.
Yes, indeed. Even as we speak, we have some friends who are, for example, joining some of the online services and actually meeting other people, finding out if they have similarities. You can even search, as we use the database skill to say search our resume software or whatever, you can search to see who else is online on a particular service like America Online, say from your hometown, or who else has a dog and other common interests. So we have a friend who's met several people in the last couple of weeks on the Sierra Network. It's just changed name to Imagination. And you play games, gamble, even have a drink down at the Electronic Bar with some other people. Besides that, though, there are actual programs that again help you probe your strengths and your likes, dislikes, and there's even one service that will put your name into a database where other people can again search for similarities or differences and meet up with you.
How do you do handwriting analysis on a computer?
More learning the different loops and what that means, and if you go too high on your H's, that's supposed to say something. And watch people with really big loops on their Y's and G's. They're supposed to be very sensuous people and all.
Uh-huh.
So I think learning, again, using it as a learning tool is the key here. Also, speaking of learning, we've run across a really interesting program lately. It's a scholarship tracker, which puts the power of the computer to work in an amazing way. Probably you remember in college that there was a scholarship for someone with a last name McKinney and red hair who lived on the 400th block of, you know, Sutter Street or something. It's they get really specific, these scholarships, and there are thousands and thousands of them. This program contains a database.
Yeah, and the easy thing is you go in there and you enter your name and you enter a few things about yourself, and it does the legwork of looking up through a list of 5,000 scholarships, and once it comes up with some potential matches, it gives you the form you have to fill out and the address you have to fill out, and it even will address the envelope for you when you run it through the printer. So you just fill the stuff out and send it out there and see what you get.
You know, so much of this seems to be trying to become aware of how much is going on, what is available, what's the data available to bring to you. I mean, that's part of the trick.
On CompuServe, I've got an executive news service, whatever that is. But I go in there, I enter some keywords, you know, like Windows is a software, you know, I play with. And so it goes through and it checks the UPI and the AP Newswire and Reuters and all those things. If anything says Windows, you know, it that story's waiting for me in the little mailbox when I log on the next day. You know, I get some stuff about Anderson's windows every once in a while and shingles. You know, but
those are nice. I like them.
But for Windows software, you also get those.
It's in there as well.
But one of the future trends we're going to be seeing, all of us, is as we get more and more home PCs, we'll be able to tailor a daily newspaper that just has articles conforming to our interests, not only on Windows, but on our various sports or business interests, too, social things. There are even programs that will lay out a front page, and you'll have your lead story right there. All individualized. I find that exciting. I think that it's time that we customize the news for ourselves.
We started out this home computer discussion with a jaded remark on my part about julienning my potatoes or something. but I understand there are some gourmet type of programs that people can use in the kitchen. What are those?
Well, it's, again, a way of keeping organized. Some of the programs let you type in your recipes and then say you can sort on them. So if you had too much broccoli sitting around and maybe some chicken, you could type in broccoli and chicken and up would pop a list of your favorite recipes that have those ingredients. Then you choose one and then the menu would be on screen. You could choose to print that out, or some people keep the keyboard right there in the kitchen. That gets a little messy, I think. Anyway, then you go from there. There are other programs, though, that specialize in gourmet cuisine. For example, you can get, say, a French cooking program that would have profiles on various French chefs and some of their creations. It's kind of fun because a lot of these recipes, for example, you know how it is with a cookbook, you kind of write down a shopping list and then go out and get these specialty ingredients that you don't normally have. Shallots, for example. I can't keep shallots in the house. They get dried out too quickly. Well, this program lets you spit out a shopping list right on your printer and then take that with you to the store so you don't forget the garlic while you're out getting the shallots.
And tying this back in with the gardening, we were looking through a recipe program just the other day that had California garden snails, which are the same snails they're eating over in France.
Right.
But it told you how to, you know, you collect them and then you blanch them by putting them in cornmeal for a couple of days, and then you've got to boil them for a while, and then five
Escargot
or six different
City.
Recipes.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, what about wines?
Well, funny you should ask that. My wife and I usually shop at a local place and buy a bottle of wine for maybe $3 or $4.99 and never any more. But we decided to splurge one day, and we got a bottle of wine that was about $16, and we drank it, and it was great. But it turned our tongues purple and our gums between our teeth. You know, whenever we smile,
like, look at your tongue, look at my tongue, and pretty soon we were going, oh, is this okay? Or?
Yeah, and I thought we'd been had, you know. And I called one of the online services and went to their wine forum, where they have people that sit at their computers and type messages back and forth about their favorite wines. and typed in the question about this expensive wine turning our tongues purple, and called back the next day, and about five people had responded and said, you know, this is normal. It does occasionally happen with the expensive wines. You know, you weren't had. And it went into a conversation about removing wine stains from your shirt collars and how white wine is good to remove red wine stains off the tablecloth.
What a waste.
Uh-huh. Really?
Well, the wines we kept.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Cheap wines. We'll do
but
it.
We even found out that the people hang out online. Once a month, they pop the same bottle or the same variety, like a Beaujolais or whatever these things are called. Anyway, and they taste it online together, type comments back and forth on the robust persnicketiness of it and all these funny words that they come up with.
That good legs. You know,
exactly.
Well, it just shows that all these home computers aren't computers that are calling other computers. They're people that are talking to other people, and the computer is just the tool that kind of disappears after a while.
That's
when
true.
You see all the stuff it can do.
Any hobby that you can imagine. We've talked about sewing, and there's cross-stitch. The quilters online are avid. The gardeners, I mean, from all over the country, are full of advice. They'll go and look up stuff in Hortus 3, the big encyclopedia of gardening. Any hobbies, model railroads, computers, help with your computer, support from other users. It's bringing people together, and you can find experts. The kids, too, love being online. They call places like Prodigy, and imagine their writing skills blossoming when they're not just talking to the teacher in a paper. They're typing back and forth and trying to use their writing skills to talk to another peer. And it's exciting to see the kids just respond, and they love it. In fact, some of the more, probably the classrooms that you're talking about with the fancy flyers and all, the teachers are using this as a definite educational tool, getting the kids to write more. That we know how important that is.
You don't know how a kid's going to learn. My youngest son learned to read from baseball cards. He was motivated. So.
Oh, yeah.
You never know. You never know what's going to do it. It occurs to me with this, it used to be that you would, if you had a hobby or you had an interest, is you would find somehow locally people who shared it, and you'd have to go to the meeting on the first Tuesday of the month, and you'd have to kind of arrange your life around this. But now with online services, it doesn't matter whether the person's down the block or, you know, three states away. And there's enough people around that if you go and you leave your message or your inquiry, then you check back, as you said, the next day. Somebody is bound to respond, if not a lot of people are bound to respond. So the idea of extending your interests through, you know, large internet-type systems and communication systems really is kind of changing the face of America. And I can imagine that all these people, you know, what's the next thing after you've made 20 friends is you'll want to have a convention, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your national convention.
Yes. And actually, your computer can not only bring you together with people that share an interest, but help you book the tickets to get there over to that national convention. You can actually make reservations on some of the online services using airline-aware programs like Easy Saber, and I'll book a rent-a-car or even find a good discount cruise for practice in getting to a foreign destination. You can use some of the simulation programs out on the shelf. There's one called Ticket to Paris where you run around like a little man in a graphic screen. You see the Eiffel Tower in one corner and Montmartre in another.
It's
you're in
like
Paris.
A game.
Yeah, it's like a game. And you're typing back and forth to, say, the hotel concierge or a boulangerie, a bakery owner, buying food, making contact with real people in French. Actually, what you do is choose between three likely French sentences and then pick the most likely one. But all the while, the game is urging you to keep your strength up by eating in Paris. And I'm wondering, who's going to forget to eat in Paris? So it's not the most realistic, but things like this are helping us to, say, fine-tune our cultural awarenesses. We know how important that can be.
Andy and Tina, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Moira.
My guests today have been Andy Rathbone, author of PCs for Dummies, and Tina Rathbone, author of hundreds of fascinating and unique ways to use your computer. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, Call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.